for 2 days per year, you get the biggest bang for your dollar, if you know what I mean. So these kind of measurements, once you understand the theory, are a good way to get an answer in a hurry. Some amateurs do it by just, you know, random variables. They try different lengths of cable and different series capacitors and parallel capacitors and inductors and hope the situation gets better. Let me drop. And if you're real crafty, you can make that work. But if you want to be a scientist, you can make the measurement and do it in one step and get the solution you're looking for. So resonance is the magic of antennas. Your highest priority is to make the antenna radiating system, antenna, feed line, balun, antenna, to make the system resonant. That's your highest priority. Your second highest priority is to make the remaining resistive component a friendly one, like 50 ohms. If it is beautifully resonant, but it's 5 ohms of resistive component, it's a little bit hard to live with. That, by the way, would be a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. So resonate first, get the right resistive component second, and after that you're home free. And with the right kind of measuring equipment like impedance measures, antenna analyzers, vector network analyzers, scalar network analyzers, Wheatstone bridge, and this impedance analyzer of Hewlett-Packard, and Hewlett-Packard had a number of different models that did that. And so depending on which model it is, that could be a fun thing to use, and hopefully you got it at a great price. John, let's hear a little bit about that. Did somebody give it to you, or did you have to spend a little bit of money for it? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. I'm down in the shack now, so I have the equipment in front of me and everything. It is an HP 4192A, as I said, LF impedance analyzer. And I paid about $200 for it, and I see that on sites like Useline and eBay and places like that, it goes for much, much more than that. But I guess what is also a bit, what I'm questioning is, if these, I already have a scalar network analyzer. I am looking forward to the days when I can be vector network analyzer, but like you said, these things are expensive, and I'm already putting out quite a cost on this equipment myself. But I got this quite cheap, so I didn't turn it down. But the question is, what does this do that vector network analyzer can't do to make it such a costly item? I'm seeing price ranges here from somewhere near $4,000 up to $6,000 for this same piece of the gear. And quite curious, what is it? So it seems to do some type of comparison, which I don't haven't claimed to do any research on it at all yet. I just bought it Saturday morning, and it's been sitting here ever since. Thought it would be a good subject for the test mat. But again, we don't have to get that deep into it. I will definitely do more reading as the week goes on and try to figure this thing out.
We electronic enthusiasts fall in love with certain brand names. You get a pristine piece of Collins radio equipment, properly advertise it with a good photograph on eBay. Even though it might be 40 years old, it can bring a good price. It's a piece of tube equipment, 1980 technology, nowhere near as stable as a modern day frequency synthesizer, but it's got that brand name of Collins. And in its day, Collins was a Cadillac, and people will pay good money for it today. And when it comes to the old TRF radio, Stromberg Carlson, I think, was a brand name that people, with a great big wooden cabinet, people will pay good money for it. Well, Hewlett-Packard is a company that some people will pay good money for it. They have fallen in love with that particular brand name, and people will pay good money for Hewlett-Packard. And whether or not it is a piece of equipment that fulfills all the modern requirements for equipment, it's for you to judge. So that's part of why it's worth a lot, in my opinion. When I get a chance, I'm going to look up the 4192A and see which method it works. And you said it does have a comparison. And therefore, it sounds like the Wheatstone Bridge pipe, where you put your unknown... Let me drop.
The comment, Dick. Quick comment.
John recognized. You put your unknown across two of the terminals, and you put another tuning device across the other terminal, and in some cases you tune that for a null, and that null tells you the impedance of your unknown. John, I wonder if you already own a a 4192A, and what you think of it. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, I do, Dick. I also have the one made by Tektronix. Haven't used them in years because of the newer equipment, but I just wanted to say that Array Solutions makes some nice analyzers. I just got a chat room message here that if you want to read about it, it's in November 2012, QST, there's a read there, and it goes through the description. Might be something you want to look at if you have the available entrance into the ARL, well, website.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, Array Solutions is one good box. It's a little bit expensive compared to another box, which is called Mini VNA. So you can do a Google search for Mini VNA. It's a bit cheaper, and actually it's a little different, and I like them both.
Eric, you have that Mini VNA, right?
Yeah, roughly how many dollars for that one, Eric?
Okay, when I bought it, it was actually a two-part device. The first part, which actually, and the cute thing about the Mini VNA is it's really designed more for hands, whereas it's got a lithium battery in it, where you literally can screw it right onto the bottom of your antenna and then via Bluetooth look at the results. That box was like 400 and something bucks, and then they had an extender box, which would take it out to 2 gigs, and that was another $600. Now, they make it all in one unit, but I don't think they have the battery in it. Anyway, it's really good. Originally, when the other unit came out, the Array Solutions unit was originally $1,900.
A question I've got for you, Eric, and that is, in the broadcast industry you work for, Channel 13 in New York City, Channel 21 out on Long Island, and you have access to all kinds of very fancy test equipment. Kind of curious as to why you go out and buy test equipment for your house when you have access to such great stuff in your industry. Over to you, Eric.
No, there's a multitude of reasons. It doesn't mean that I don't borrow stuff that I have, but something you're not really going to borrow because it's in line and in use, big and heavy, or, you know, $60,000 plus, you don't really want to be responsible for it. But, fittingly enough, a broadcast station, in essence, if we bought a VNA, how often would it get used? When I need a VNA, generally I'll either do one of two things. That one, we'll bring in the consulting engineer who likes doing this stuff, and they pay him anyway, so what the heck?
It's also fun to own some of these things, and so if the price is right, it's fun to own. So, we amateurs, we're collectors. In fact, the biggest VHF club, arguably, on the East Coast, is the Mount Airy VHF Society. And on their logo, it says Pack Rats. You visit any one of the Mount Airy VHF Society members in the Philadelphia area, and there's probably 300 of them. I'll bet you at least half of them have a basement that's just filled up with test equipment and pieces of electronics that they've collected over the years. We collect stuff. And one of the philosophers I used to work with told me that the process of living, as a scientist, the process of living is the process of collecting things. Eventually, they come and collect you. Let's see. I think with reference to impedance measuring, it sounds like Wes has a question on that one. N2XJN, K2LHW. Go ahead, Wes.
Some of the conclusions in field of vector network analyzers. It is kind of understandable that everything that is made in millions is extremely inexpensive. Like the question was the price, like the cell phone. And actually it's a very sophisticated device. So you now lose a part of something that you have to make, and it's custom, it costs you a lot of money, sometimes more than you paid for the device. The good thing is that if you buy the second hand, you can get a hand on something that costs half a million dollars, and you pay $200 or $50. There was a comment of one of the people that I spoke to, it's a German scientist. He said, people have to justify what is that they need. So if it is something for the monkey, it must be on the level, brain level of the monkey. And the monkey will justify whether they need the new speaker system, 2,000 watts for his car, or maybe vector network analyzer. It's very much unpleasant comment, but it makes a sense. And it actually says about the price. Etrigia.
Just about every automobile, just about every piece of equipment, ham radio, test equipment, whatever, that I've ever owned is used. My philosophy, as long as you choose a brand name and a model number that has a good track record, quite often used equipment will cost you a very small percentage of the brand new price. And so you get a lot for your money. As long as you think you have the ability to repair things, within reason, I can repair many things that fail on my automobile. I can repair many things that fail on my test equipment or on my ham radio equipment. So the chances of me getting a lemon are very slim, but I did get a lemon once. There is a particular model number of a 432 megacycle all-mode rig made by ICOM. I think it was the ICOM 471, where there was a whole production run where they did not do the proper job of cleaning off the rosin from the flow solder machine. And the very active solder, very active rosin flux material was slowly eating into all of the variable capacitors in all of the printed circuit boards and making all of them intermittent. That was a rig that I wasn't able to fix. That was one case where I got a lemon. And even though I cleaned off the board, replaced all those capacitors, it was just a matter of time. Let me drop it. It's just a matter of time before the remaining flux that was in the multiple layers of the printed circuit board migrated through into the brand new variable capacitors and ate them up also. The little rotary bearing that's in that air variable capacitor, when that starts making intermittent contact, boy, you can get all kinds of crazy responses of a modern day frequency synthesized rig. So there was once when I did get a lemon where my philosophy failed. But for the all of the other pieces of test equipment I've ever bought, and automobiles and things like that, appliances that I bought, I'm a big enthusiast of used. Now, let's see, John, I know you've got a radar question, and that's one of my favorite subjects. And this guy, John...
Before you go on, modern-day test equipment, that's becoming more and more of a problem, where you can't add to them, blown the components that they custom manufacture.
So you're saying that when you can't get the schematic, it's going to really slow you down when it comes to troubleshooting. But I'll bet you there are a couple of cases, Eric, where you took an unknown circuit that you wanted to troubleshoot and repair and make work better, and you put it under your fluorescent ring lighting circuit on your desk with a great big magnifying glass in the middle, and you worked out what was the schematic diagram, you figured out the circuit, and you fixed it anyway. I'll bet you walked down that aisle on a couple of occasions. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Unfortunately, that's happened too many times, and you've never heard so many curse words come out of my mouth. But ultimately, in the end, sometimes it's quick, sometimes it takes months, depends upon how much patience you have. But even in stuff that, you know, the seven-year cycle that we live in, how long a manufacturer has to support something after end of life. Once you reach that threshold, like Tektronix, for example, that make the custom circuitry on a little piece of ceramic substrate that has all sorts of really fancy things on it, and you have an idea of what it is because it's a block, but, you know, unless you're lucky enough to have a microscope and the patience to replace whatever defective components, assuming it hasn't been potted, things like that can be somewhat problematic.
Steve says with comment.
Go ahead, Al.
Okay, first of all, you mentioned all the impedance measuring devices. The one I use is a 1650 GR bridge for antenna measurements. That's used in the broadcast field extensively. I'm sure you're familiar with it, Eric. And as far as some parts of the test equipment, I've gone the gamut myself. Where I've done like a 40B, they have those modules, and the broadband amplifiers. Very hard to get. So I cut the top of the module off, put a mimic, and made it work. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, that general radio impedance measuring device, in its day, which was probably the late 60s, it was the way to measure impedance. By modern day standards, it's a relatively difficult thing to use, but it works, does the job. Now, John's going to ask us a question about radar, and I make some fun with John from time to time. John has worked with radar so often that he knows how to spell it backwards. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, sometimes I can find the on and off switch. It works. But I have a radar question on a system that you've become a little familiar with. We were speaking about it. And I wanted to know if what they're trying to do is possible. So let me get a drop and I'll give you a quick description of what's happening. Okay, this is 25 kW power level. It is a dual pulse radar. Okay, I think it's Peruno, I'm not sure. But what they've done is they have a transmission antenna which is mounted center of the ship, and on the fore and aft they have two receiving antennas, and they're separated by 31 meters. One is set at 10 meters high, and the other one is 20 meters high. And what they're doing is the signals that they are receiving are sent into an A&D in a computer system, a large computer system, and they're creating 3D images. Do you think that's possible? Just wanted a quick answer from you to see if you think what they're working on is true.
Oh, absolutely. The word radar is such an extremely vast field of various kinds of electronics these days. Synthetic aperture radar, inverse synthetic aperture radar, air intercept pulse Doppler radar. I mean, you just use some of the fancy words, range Doppler matrix, Doppler display only type radars and so on. I have seen radars that with a lot less antenna equipment than you're describing that are able to make a three-dimensional picture of the target. You got to have create some motion, though. In one case, the aircraft has to fly a circular path around the target, and by inverse synthetic aperture, you're able to eventually make a photograph of the target, the object itself. So, by way of the antennas on the bow and the stern of the ship, by way of the antennas have a different altitude, you can do various kinds of interferometry, particularly if you're sweeping in frequency. The double pulses, in some cases, the two pulses are slightly different frequencies.
Different frequencies. Not by much, but they are different.
Yep. So by having different frequencies, which means you're getting a different phase angle of the reflection of the target, that gives you additional information. So if you got fast, if you got smart enough post-detection degradation, digital signal processing, if the back end of that radar has enough digital signal processing, if the front end of the radar has got a good enough frequency synthesizer and can hop in frequencies, if the antennas themselves can be steered to various directions, can you make a three-dimensional picture out of that? Absolutely. Now, is that picture going to be as good as a photograph? Absolutely not. But will you be able to recognize that, hey, that target is a fighter, not a bomber? Absolutely. Will you be able to recognize whether or not it's an F-16 or an F-18? Maybe not. But maybe yes. So, radar systems that give you visualization, that give you imaging radars. There's a whole class of radars that do imaging. Side-looking radars, for instance, as you fly over a particular terrain, can give you something that looks like a photograph of the terrain you're flying over, even though you did it at nighttime on a foggy night. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to get your opinion to see if what these guys were doing is, what they're telling me is truthful. Because sometimes they, you know, can't count on it. But, all right, very interesting. I'm going to try to get some more information from them. I spoke to one of them this morning, Steve, and he was telling me actually what they were doing. So, interesting stuff. But you're right, it was a radar unit, so everything went well, as I told you. Okay, thank you for answering the question, KC2WGB.
In our phone conversations over that piece of electronics that you're repairing and our speculations as to how it's being used, were some of our guesses close to correct as to what was the malady they were seeing? When they finally described what was on the screen, were we at least close in our assumptions, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I believe you were right on. The display unit on the bridge was not the problem. It was the display unit where they were trying to create the 3D imaging that was giving them all kinds of spurious signals, and that's why they determined it was that device that I mentioned, but it turned out that's not it. It has to do with their digital processing has to be improved.
Yeah, one of the things that's kind of interesting that happens when you've got, let's say, multiple aircraft, multiple ships, let's say, come into a harbor, and each ship has its own radar that allows them to see on a foggy day what's in front of them to make sure they don't crash into things like the Andrea Doria did, which, by the way, was a radar failure where the synchronization was mixed up by 90 degrees so that the real target was straight ahead, and yet the radar screen was showing the target off to the eastern side of the ship and created great confusion and a collision to take place. But my point is that when you've got multiple radars in the near vicinity of each other, and that near vicinity could mean they're in the same harbor, or in the case of the situation I saw, it means they're in the same county. The L-band radar that existed at Airborne Instruments Laboratory in Deer Park, New York, was something that I used to visit whenever I had any free time. I would go down to that laboratory and look at that radar screen because they had the thing running 24 hours a day, particularly in the summertime. This 1290 megacycle radar would sometimes light up the whole east coast of the United States. Even though the radar had maximum 200 mile range, you would see targets out almost 1,000 miles. You would look at the whole coastline of Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, North Carolina. When there were certain kinds of super refraction weather conditions taking place in the summertime, you would see the whole coastline of the United States on that radar screen. Let me drop. In the days of the late 60s and early 70s, there was another L-band radar, probably an ASR radar in those days, working at Kennedy Airport. And so as the antenna from the Kennedy Airport radar swept in the direction of Deer Park, and the antenna of Deer Park swept anywhere near that direction, you would see funny signals on the screen. They called them fruit. The signals would look like a dotted spirograph signal, dots on the screen, and they, from trace to trace, they would not repeat, if you know what I mean, but you get these funny diagrams. So when a radar is, doesn't even have to be on the exact same frequency, it can be a large number of megacycles away, and in some cases, even on another band, a very well-operating radar, the majority of the energy during the pulse is on the center frequency of that pulse. Let me drop. But if the radar is working real well, and on the beginning of each pulse it has a rise time that's in the nanoseconds or picoseconds, and the full time might be in the nanoseconds or picoseconds, it is making extremely brief pulses of energy that is many gigahertz wide. And so your particular radar is getting these very brief pulses from another radar that trace artifacts onto your radar screen, onto your planned position indicator, that if you haven't seen it in the past, it can confuse the daylights out of you as a radar operator. And the slang that they used at AIL at the time is fruit. We're getting fruit on that screen from another radar. And there's a fancy kind of a circuit you can deploy, which is a certain kind of a impulse blanker, which they used to call the defruiting circuit. So the word radar is becoming a very complicated word these days. You take a radar that is agile. By that I mean each individual pulse it transmits might be on a different frequency. Each individual pulse might, by a different pulse duration, interval might be a different duration. So the rep rate is continuously varying, the pulse duration is continuously varying, the frequency it transmits is continuously varying. Let me drop it. And if it's a pulse compression radar, which means the signal is swooping in frequency during the pulse, and when you go through the right kind of a pulse compression demodulator circuit in the radar, you can now get the higher sensitivity, greater range resolution out of this chirped radar. So, as you can see, there's at least four different kinds of agility a radar can have, changing frequency during the pulse, as well as all those other things. And you try to jam a radar that has all of that agility, you're going to be wasting your time spending an awful lot of energy on frequencies that are thoroughly ineffective and timing that's thoroughly ineffective. So when a radar operator pulls out all the stops and you're in that war of electronic countermeasures, electronic countermeasures, and so on, the guy who designs the radar is winning the war in many cases these days. Anybody have any further questions on this subject before we go on? Give me your call letters, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Another question about that then.
Okay. I heard Wes, but there was another person. Who was that other person?
N2APG, Nancy 2 Alpha Papa Golf.
Yeah, I heard you first, Dave. So go ahead with your question, Dave.
Yeah, it's a radar question, but it's also basically, I guess, avionics. And the reason I ask, it's I was watching that classic movie Failsafe about a week ago. And if you remember the movie, when the Americans try to shoot down the B-58 bombers that are headed towards Moscow, you know, they come up behind them and they shoot the air-to-air missiles and they fail in that. In the movie, they don't show any reference that the B-58 pilots were aware, you know, that they were being shot at from the back, from the rear. Of course, it's a movie, it's fictional. So my question has to do with avionics radar. Are they able to, you know, detect airplanes only in the front, or can they detect planes coming up from behind them? Would in real life, would they would know that somebody's shooting at them from behind?
Let me think now. Starting in roughly 1975 up until essentially 2000, so that's what, 25 years. Of my 35 years of service at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, AIL, 25 of those years were spent on and off on the B-1B bomber program. And a good number of those years were spent on the module called the tail warning radar. So there was not only a radar out of the nose of the airplane up front, but there was a tail warning radar that looked at anything coming up your tail, whether it be another aircraft or a missile. And so by way of measuring Doppler of the echo you got from the thing that you see coming up your tail, you would know right away that a certain kind of missile is coming toward you, and therefore you could automatically apply countermeasures, the right kind of jamming, the right kind of chaff dispensing, and other techniques. So does a modern-day significant bomber contain a tail warning radar? You bet it does, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
N2APG. Yeah, I figured that would probably be the case. So a civilian airplane, like a jetliner, a commercial jetliner, they would probably only have a forward-looking radar. They want to see stuff, you know, that's in front of them. They really wouldn't have anything like that that would be, you know, looking behind them. Am I correct in that?
I think that's correct. The forward-looking radar, the main thing it's looking for is adverse weather conditions. You don't want to fly into the middle of a raging thunderstorm. So you'd like to fly around it, and your radar would like to give you that. With rare exception, a commercial airliner doesn't get shot at, so you don't invest all the money of a tail warning radar. Unless you're flying in some very dangerous territories. Your virtual question is, has there ever been a commercial airliner that had a tail warning radar or the equivalent on board? I don't know of one, but if someone gave me information that in a particular incident it did take place, I would believe it. There are kinds of radars that are not necessarily super expensive. The majority of them are pretty expensive. In order to put something requirements of not creating an electromagnetic interference to complete, to give you complete compatibility with all other pieces of electronics on board. And that's a pretty tall order. It takes a pretty fancy piece of electronics to do its function without interfering with all the other pieces of electronics on board. Let me drop it.
DPZ with a comment.
About Air Force One.
DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, I'm guessing Air Force One's got all kinds of radars. And so, you know, when you go on a commercial airliner, even with permission, it's doubtful as to whether or not you're allowed to use a handy-talkie, because your handy-talkie on that airliner could interfere with their electronics on board. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
Don't forget, Air Force One flies with cover.
Okay, Dick. Now, I've worked with avionics radars. They primarily use X-band radar, mainly in the nose section. They don't have commercial aircraft, and so on. And there's no need to put rear radar, but I think on Air Force One they have also rear radar and a lot of other little things as far as it goes. But the WX radar primarily is X-band, and it's a straightforward type of unit. That's all my comment is, Dick. I've worked on many X-band radars.
The NEXRAD radar, the highest resolution weather indicating radar, is an S-band radar. Ground-based. Have any of the airborne radars ever used S-band? Because in some cases, weather shows up a little bit better in S-band than it does in X-band. Over to you, Al.
Not that I know of, Dick. Not the stuff I've seen. I've never seen S-band. Primarily, you know, X-band does primarily what they need to look at cloud formation to be able to fly around the clouds.
One of the main reasons why radars on an aircraft are either X-band or KU-band is because you've got a rather small amount of area in that radome up front. And so an X-band or a KU-band antenna, a small antenna that's, let's say, a foot wide or so, maybe a foot and a half wide, can easily fit in there and gives you a reasonable amount of narrow beamwidth, 1, 2, 3 degrees of beamwidth, so you can get a pretty good picture. An S-band radar with way down at 2.8 gigahertz, you can't put a big enough antenna in there to get much of a desirable beamwidth. You're going to get a very wide beamwidth. So for a bunch of reasons, I can see why airborne probably makes very little use of S-band, with the exception of a side-looking radar where now the antenna is along the whole length of the fuselage. That's a very different system. L-band and S-band are sometimes used there. The other person who had a question on some of these subjects was Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, you have source of the signal, and then you have two kinds of antenna. One is a vertical and horizontal polarization, so it's a dual polarized antenna, and the other one is slant antenna, so slant polarization. Both of them at the same distance from the signal source. And now, my question would be, and the antenna of the signal source is omnidirectional, what would be the difference in signal received for both those antennas, for the receiver and to receive?
And you brought up another good point. When it comes to super agile radars, some of the radars will put out different polarizations of the signals on alternate pulses, clockwise versus counterclockwise. Transmit and receive, slant right versus slant left, horizontal versus vertical. In the case of a circular polarized clockwise signal transmitted by a weather radar, when it hits drops of water, the drops of water will give you an echo that's of the opposite polarization. A clockwise signal will give you primarily a counterclockwise echo. I may have that backwards. And so when you use the right kind of circular and counterclockwise circular polarization sensing, you can differentiate between weather echo and aircraft echo. Quite often, an aircraft echo, you're really getting a compound bounce where the signal is bouncing first off the wing, then off the fuselage, then coming back to you. And in general, you get a polarization reversal to some degree on each individual bounce on circular polarization. It doesn't happen on horizontal. A horizontal signal after echo is still primarily horizontal, and the same with vertical, and the same with slant.
quite a few of your targets have a property called chirality. Let me drop.
Dick, doesn't rain drops sort of scatter the polar rays?
Not really. Each individual raindrop echo is, each individual raindrop is a point source reflecting device, which, yes, it is sending the signal of echo back in a lot of different directions. That's true. But the way the signal goes into the water droplet, it excites and re-radiates. You do get a polarization reversal of clockwise versus counterclockwise. So, I, for one, have used my X-band, my 10 gigahertz ham radio equipment, to reflect signals off of rain clouds. And so, when I was talking to a guy in the Boston area quite a few years ago, where there's a mountain between him and I, we could never hear each other directly, but there was a rain cloud off to the west of the both of us. We both aimed at that rain cloud and got a beautiful echo. However, you get some peculiar echoes off of rain with polarization. Let me drop.
Oh, it's the satellite that I asked. Pull up that up.
Okay. When you've got high isolation between clockwise and counterclockwise, like many of the Ku-band satellites use, and they also use a kind of frequency reuse. In other words, your transponder number one and transponder number three are two adjacent channels, one and three. Transponder number two overlaps the two, halfway between the two. Center frequency is exactly at the edge of each of them, number one and number three. They do that frequency reuse by having clockwise for the odds and counterclockwise for the evens. And on a clear blue sky day, that downlink system from a broadcast geosynchronous satellite works like a charm. On a rainy day, let me drop. On a rainy day, many of our satellite television reception systems stop working. And it would be very easy to say, okay, the rain created attenuation, we're not getting enough signal. There's a small degree of that taking place. The majority of the degree that's taking place is that the raindrops are now mixing together the overlapping frequencies of clockwise and counterclockwise. The carefully tuned 30 decibels or so of isolation in the downlink, because they're making very pure clockwise on the odd channels and very pure counterclockwise on the even channels, and the scattering you get off of the raindrops mixes those together. And so all of a sudden, the demodulator in your ground station receiver is seeing, when it's listening to channel 2, transponder number 2, it's seeing some of the signal from number 1 and 3 because of what the raindrops are doing. So that cross-polarization mixing of raindrops is the primary reason you get failure of your GPS, of your satellite receiving system. I think you and I have had some discussion on this before, Eric. K-E-Q-E-J, K-2-R-I-W.
Yes, we have, but since you were talking about radar, weather sensing radar, it would seem that that effect would have a definite effect in terms of what the radar gets back after it sends, say, a right-hand circling polarized signal, what comes back at it. And the fact that it's circular has its advantages, but still, if it's doing that kind of scattering, what does the radar think of it when it receives it?
If you want to get maximum display of a rain cloud on a radar system that's using circular polarization, you will transmit clockwise and receive counterclockwise. The majority of the echo you get off of the raindrops are the reverse polarization, so you get the greatest visibility on your screen if you're transmitting clockwise and receiving counterclockwise, or vice versa. I think that's what you're referring to, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. But now the concept of scattering, because now you're saying that when that right-hand circularly polarized signal hits the raindrop, it's going to come back as a left-hand circularly polarized signal. Whereas that when I think about satellites, it's usually in this neck of the woods where you're horizontal and vertical, that the mixing of the two, but I forget about the fact that we're really talking about two different transmitters that are circling in the same neighborhood as one another. So, radar really doesn't have to deal with that. The fact that it's getting a reflection
the original pulse that it sent out doesn't, you don't wind up with those kinds of problems that you do with a satellite. That's what I was thinking of that.
The raindrop really is an ultra-miniature dipole that you excite and it re-radiates. At 1 inch at a time, if my signal coming out of my transmitter hitting the raindrop is a horizontally polarized signal, either because I'm transmitting horizontal or I've analyzed this nanosecond of time in which the circular polarization happens to be horizontal at this instant. An instant later, it's going to be a little bit, instead of going from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, the polarization is going to go from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock. The polarization rotates at the carrier rate. That's what makes circular polarization. But at this instant of time, you could say that the individual atoms of that raindrop, the individual molecules of the water, are getting a signal which is at this instant of the RF cycle making the right side of the raindrop positive and the left side negative. It really is a miniature dipole that's below resonance, but it doesn't matter. It's still being excited by the RF wave, and it's re-emitting that wave. So the instant of horizontal polarization that the signal went into the raindrop comes back re-radiated again as horizontal polarization. However, because the clockwise rotation of being re-emitted becomes counterclockwise. Let me backtrack on that one.
Wow, the quantum physics of this has got to be really interesting.
Yeah, it's got a specific name. It's called either Mie scattering or Rayleigh scattering. I keep confusing the two. I think it's Mie scattering. When the device doing the echoing is very small compared to a wavelength, the echo signal you get falls off at 12 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. So it's a ultra-miniature re-radiating antenna. But any circular polarized signal striking a flat metallic plate, the plate, at each instant of time, there is a certain polarization of the signal that's hitting the plate, and the plate is re-radiating that signal. Well, a clockwise signal going from me and away from me, that exact same rotation of signal, when it's propagating in the other direction, coming back toward me, is really the opposite sense. You send out clockwise, after echo, it is counterclockwise. So whether the echo is taking place from a flat metal sheet or from individual raindrops, the phenomena is somewhat similar. You get the opposite circular polarization. But it's not a funny thing that happens with raindrop reflections. Let me drop this one. Unfortunately, the majority of people on the East Coast have set a standard where the majority of us use horizontal polarization on the 10 gigahertz ham band. And when you're reflecting signals off of raindrops, the echo off of a raindrop works very well broadside, but edgewise it doesn't. By that I mean the signal I'm sending to that raindrop with my horizontally polarized transmission, the right side of the raindrop is positive, the left side is negative at this instant, and that raindrop is re-radiating both forward and coming back toward me. But notice that a signal that I would like to be reflected from that raindrop off at a right angle, 90 degrees away, because that right side and left side of the raindrop, from my point of view, is now, when viewed 90 degrees away, it is the near side and the far side of the raindrop, cannot radiate a signal when the polarization is parallel to the direction of propagation. You get a null in that direction. So if that rain cloud that was over western Massachusetts happened to be so positioned, if it happened to be so positioned so that when I aimed the signal at the rain cloud and the signal that bounced off the rain cloud, I wanted it to go to my buddy in Boston, and if that angle of bounce was 90 degrees, he would have been in the know for horizontal polarization. He would not be in the know for vertical polarization. A number of amateurs have actually done that experiment and seen that effect, where a 90 degree reflection, you get a beautiful scattering 90 degrees away if the original signal is vertically polarized, because now the top and the bottom of the raindrop is positive and negative at that instant of time, and that is re-radiating a signal omnidirectionally all the way around the horizon. It just happens to be creating a null straight up and straight down where hams are not there, if you know what I mean. So there's a distinct advantage of using vertical polarization on the 10 gig ham band when you're doing rain scatter. And it's interesting to note a number of guys in California on the X-band are then getting M band average output. For this reason, a good number of the 10 gig hems in California use vertical polarization, even though we on the East Coast set a standard a long time ago of horizontal. And so, without special agreement of the guy you're talking to and without reorienting your antenna, we use very little vertical. To change a horizontal antenna to a vertical antenna in the case of a parabolic dish, mechanically, that could be difficult if you don't have the right kind of a rotary joint. Over to you for any comments on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
There's somebody on ILLC who's hanging things up here. That's really interesting, Dick. And in terms of what we do here, of course, you know, money no object, so dual feed horns, one horizontal, one vertical. But now, I follow everything that you're saying. The thing that's got me interested now is the physics of the raindrop of that X number of molecules of water actually re-radiating the signal as opposed to a piece of metal. But I guess the physics is really kind of the same. Care to dive into that a little bit?
Yeah, I believe this is somewhat related to what goes on with a microwave oven. First of all, a water molecule is a significantly polarized molecule. Logically, you would think that it would be HOH. In other words, a hydrogen atom at the 12 o'clock position, oxygen atom in the middle, another hydrogen atom at the 6 o'clock position. That's the way you think Mother Nature would make a water molecule. For reasons that are a little bit mysterious to me, the water molecule has the two hydrogen atoms on one side of the oxygen atom, and the two hydrogen atoms are offset from each other by something like 109 degrees, a crazy number. And so, as such, the end of the water molecule that's nearest those two hydrogen atoms, that end is positive. The end that's the end away from that, the bare oxygen end, is negative. So a water molecule is polarized. As such, the microwave signal in your microwave oven is taking every one of those water molecules and rotating them back and forth on each half cycle of the RF energy. Let me drop. Those water molecules are zipping back and forth, rotating, following each half cycle. At the exact same instant of time, all those water molecules are moving on average something like 600 meters per second, simply because the water molecules are at, let's say in the beginning, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So the water molecules are bouncing against each other very rapidly. They make a zero energy bounce, if you know what I mean. The air molecules are doing the same thing, by the way. But when they're rotating at the exact same time as they're bouncing, every so often, the bumpy side of the water molecule where the two hydrogen atoms are is being rotated against the other water molecule. So because of the presence of the microwave signal, the water molecules that bounce against each other while rotating end up bouncing away with greater velocity, greater speed than they had before the beginning of the bounce because of the rotation phenomena. That is the, in my opinion, this is the primary mechanism by which RF energy is absorbed by water so efficiently, and the water gets heated. Water being heated really means that the average kinetic energy of the water molecules is greater, and the majority of that kinetic energy is translational energy, the speed at which they're moving and hitting each other. Let me drop. So in the microwave oven, those water molecules are rotating. I believe the water molecules in the raindrop are also doing a kind of rotating at a much more minor degree because of the RF energy that's hitting them. They're also doing absorption and re-radiation. When you get a reflected signal off of a dielectric material, like the reflection you get off of a sheet of glass at a grazing angle, angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, absolutely. What's really happening is that you're exciting some of the glass molecules that are near the surface of the glass. They absorb some of the light energy and re-radiate it. And if you're using vertical polarization into a glass bounce by that exact same phenomenon I mentioned earlier where you get a null in the direction at 90 degrees, when the angle of incident and the angle of reflection off of glass is at a 90 degree angle with vertically polarized light wave going in, you get a no. The reflection disappears. That's part of the mechanism by which polarized glasses will give you less reflection off of seawater or off of windows. Is this a absorption and re-radiation phenomena where the individual molecules doing the re-radiating at a 90 degree angle with vertical polarization are trying to send a signal that is the plus and minuses are in the exact same direction as the desired direction of transmission, and therefore you get a no. You cannot transmit a signal where the polarization is parallel to the direction of propagation. Mother Nature won't let you do that. It's got to be a transverse electromagnetic wave. The E field and the H field has got to be at right angles to the direction of propagation. I wonder if it's ever been explained to you before that way. It's called excitation and extinction. That they give it some words like that that mean something that is spelled slightly differently, describing the note you get off of the reflection from a dielectric material. A mirror doesn't do that, but dielectric material like glass does. Water does. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
N2NPR.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, in the case of glass, when we're talking about light, we're still dealing with wave theory here. So, in essence, to put it simply, the fact that I excited one, let's just say, one little layer of molecule on the surface of the drop of water at that particular rate or that particular frequency requires those molecules are vibrating at that particular frequency. It's re-radiating that energy. Is that a simple way of saying it?
NPR. I think it is. It sounds like N2NPR. N2 November Proper Radio is what it sounds like. Please correct me, and please tell us your name. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. My name is John. Handle here. QTH here is Northern West Houston, and my call is November 2, November, Bravo, Romeo. I just have a question concerning the polarity factor and the malfeasant radar. I think it was on the Andrea Doria. Maybe that was an issue. I'm curious about that. What do you think?
Yeah, it turns out the Andrea Doria radar happened to have an engineer that I knew of, who taught me radar engineering, by the way, who happened to work on that radar. Rotating magnetic field structure that was on the cathode ray tube of the planned position indicator. The display, the radar display on the ship had a rotating magnet that was supposed to move identical to the way the antenna is moving. But that rotating magnetic assembly was done with a kind of a Selsyn motor. The Selsyn motor had a gear train connected to it. And so when it comes to synchronizing that Selsyn motor, there was either three or four different ways it could synchronize. And the person who turned on the radar that day didn't do the synchronization correctly. Therefore, if a target was directly forward of the ship, right off the bow, it would be displayed on that screen as if it was due east. And so the radar operator was trying to tell the warehouse which way to steer the ship so as not to collide with this thing that was coming toward them. And from their point of view, the thing coming toward them was coming into the side. And they just couldn't steer away from it. No matter which direction they steered, it kept coming at them from their point of view because of the ambiguity of that radar. As I said, I know somebody who worked on that radar. I won't tell you what brand name it was, but it had that fallacy if it wasn't properly aligned when you turned it on. Into NBR, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, yeah, but I don't suppose it helped them in the settlement, you know, in the that occurred in some courtroom somewhere, but because I think the Andrea Doria was in the Stockholm's burden zone. So, however, that's nevertheless interesting. Thank you, Dick. I look forward to your further commentary on this radar. I don't know. I have one radar that a fellow boater gave me, and I would like to convert it to something in the ham radio frequency, but I haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Yeah, I think the lowest frequency where we hams are allowed to use pulse modulation for radar-like pulses, I think, is the X-band ham band. Although, we're allowed to transmit pulses, but we're not allowed to transmit radar. There's a bit of a conflict of definitions here. I'm quite often amazed by, when court cases like that take place, the individual details as to why ambiguity on the screen took place. Sometimes those details are not revealed. You take, for instance, the flight 587 that crashed in Queens, not very long after 9/11. That particular aircraft, when you study that aircraft model number and serial number in the FAA records, you find out that it had a number of tail strikes, which did damage to that vertical stabilizer, and the vertical stabilizer arrived from Europe with a crack in it, and the technicians in New York City tried to cure the crack by drilling some holes above and below the crack and screwing down a piece of metal on the inside. In the case of graphite reinforced materials, that does not reestablish the strength. So therefore, that was a weakened vertical stabilizer because of the crack, the improper, in my opinion, repair procedure, and the tail strikes that thing had before that day when the vertical stabilizer came off and the airplane started flying sideways so violently that it ripped both engines off of their nacelles. That's the only time in history that both engines left the airplane before the airplane struck the ground. Those details of the crack on arrival and the tail strikes was never brought out in the investigation. I'm amazed. And to NBR for any of the comments, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, that's about all I can think of now, but that Henry Azoria thing fascinates me. I wonder what the weather conditions were like, in case you might know.
I believe it was a cloudy day. They did not have visualization of the two ships. And they did strike. One struck the other one broadside, and the broadside strike, the ship that was struck broadside, I believe, sank. I think you know more of those details than I do, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks very much. I appreciate that. A friend of mine spread that broadcast world and aircraft leaving. I guess it was Boston or wherever the heck it took off from. And he was fascinated by all this. So next time I see him, I'll tell him about it. Anyway, very good. Thank you. And I appreciate it. Back to you, Dick.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, the Stockholm is the one that took the nose hit. Went right into it like a torpedo and sunk that ship. It really caved it in something fierce. If you see the Stockholm damage, it was quite a bit of damage, but that's what happened.
To your knowledge, John, you probably have better memory than I do of that incident. How much of the details of the radar error do you think were brought out in the investigation of how that collision in the fog took place? Back to you, John.
Dick, I don't think I remember reading anything about that, but, you know, the only way to find that out is, I guess, to you know, maybe look on the internet if you can find the courtroom proceedings on the subject. The distinct possibility that you might not even known about it at that point in time. What do you think?
Yeah, I created an ambiguity. I passed it back to John, but I didn't say which John. In this case, were any of the details of the radar error brought out, John, KC2WGB, WGB, K2RIW?
KC2WGB, not to my knowledge. All I know is they said the radar was not working properly, and it sounded like radar wasn't working in a way that was going to be beneficial for navigation, and it was a foggy day, but they didn't say why the radar wasn't working. Or they didn't even mention that the radar operator maybe made an error. As far as I'm concerned, they just glossed over that point from what I remember. It was a long time ago.
I'm always amazed when the fine details of publicly available information are not brought out. People who are assigned the task of investigating why the accident took place, how they ignore things that are publicly available. from time to time, it amazes me. And nobody, the attorneys involved don't seem to be worried about those details. I think it's time we